You know that feeling, right? That little clinch in your stomach when the check engine light just pops on out of nowhere.
Oh, yeah. Or that sound, that hiss, flat tire. Ugh.
Exactly. Or maybe it's just that nagging voice in your head saying you are way overdue for an oil change. Again,
Happens to the best of us.
it really does. And look, car trouble or even just routine maintenance, it's just, well, it's part of owning a vehicle for pretty much everyone.
It's unavoidable.
Right. And while it might be a bit of a headache for you and me, it actually fuels this massive, incredibly resilient, and honestly, often overlooked
It
industry.
really is huge.
I actually tried changing my own oil once. Let's just say I ended up wearing more of it than the car did.
Been there, sort of.
That was the moment I truly appreciated, someone else doing it, or at least having the right parts easily available.
Yeah.
So today we're doing a deep dive into O'Reilly Automotive Inc. You probably know the stock ticker, ORLY.
Or why, yeah.
It's a company that's kind of quietly become this absolute titan in keeping our cars running, especially here in North America.
They're everywhere.
And they're not just, another auto parts store down the street. They are a formidable presence in what's called the automotive aftermarket.
Which is basically everything that happens to a car after it's first sold.
Right.
Repairs, maintenance, upgrades.
Exactly. It's a part of the economy that touches all of us, really, whether we think about it much or not. Our goal here in this deep dive is to really pull back the curtain on O'Reilly. We want to show you why it's not just a place to grab an oil filter.
No, it's much more than that.
It's a fascinating case study in business resilience, strategic thinking, and just really consistent execution over a long time.
Decades, really.
We're going to explore its unique business model. It's quite clever, actually. We'll look at the incredibly durable industry it operates in.
Super stable industry.
We'll dig into its competitive advantages, the things that make it so tough for others to keep up, and of course, the powerful financial engine driving its success.
Yep, the numbers are pretty impressive.
But we'll also look at the challenges because, no road is perfectly smooth forever. And the strategies O'Reilly is using to adapt for a future that looks, well, pretty different from the past.
Electrification being a big one.
Right. The whole point is for you, our listener, to walk away with a really well-informed, comprehensive perspective on this crucial slice of our transportation world.
And to give you that full picture, we've pulled together a pretty hefty stack of sources. We've got detailed investment analyses from some top firms. We've dug into their recent earnings call transcripts,
So direct from management.
direct from management, plus their annual reports, of course, and a good amount of broader industry research to put it all in context.
This is a solid foundation.
Yeah, it's a complete set of insights, everything you need to get a handle on it.
All right. So, to really understand this giant, we got to start by looking under its own hood, right? Let's talk about its core business and this dual market strategy they have.
Absolutely. So, O'Reilly Automotive, Inc. It's a specialty retailer, but with a long history. Started way back in 1957. Just a single store in Springfield, Missouri.
Wow, one store.
One store. And since then, through organic growth, opening new stores, and some smart acquisitions along the way, they've grown into a real market leader.
What exactly do they sell? It seems like everything.
Pretty much. They offer this just vast array of automotive aftermarket parts, tools, supplies, equipment, accessories, you name it.
Okay, break that down a bit. What kind of parts are we talking about?
Think about the really critical stuff, the essential hard parts. Things like alternators, batteries, brake components, calipers, rotors, pads, the stuff that makes your car go, and importantly, stop.
The non-negotiables.
Exactly. But it's not just the urgent fixes. They also stock all the crucial maintenance items. Your motor oil filters, air filters, fuel filters, all the fluids that keep things lubricated and cool.
The everyday stuff.
Right. And then you've got the accessories, floor mats, seat covers, wiper blades, car cleaning supplies, the whole spectrum.
So from major engine components down to like an air freshener.
Pretty much. It's a comprehensive catalog, and it's all built on having the parts available when you need them and making it convenient for customers. They cater to basically any need a car owner or professional mechanic might have.
And what's really striking about that, when you lay it all out, is why this business model is so powerful. The sources keep emphasizing that it addresses fundamental and non-discretionary needs.
That's the key phrase.
What does that really mean for us, the average person?
It means basically when your car breaks down, you have to fix it.
Right.
For most people, reliable transportation isn't a luxury. You need it for work, for family for life.
You can't just put it off indefinitely.
Not usually. It's essential. And this positions O'Reilly as this incredibly critical and maybe more importantly, really recession-resilient part of a whole transportation ecosystem.
So good times or bad times, people still need parts.
Exactly. Whether the economy's flying high or hitting a rough patch, cars still need maintenance, they still break down. That underlying demand, it just doesn't vanish.
That makes sense. It provides a really stable base.
Precisely. And that leads us right into what I think is one of O'Reilly's most powerful strategic weapons. Their dual market strategy.
Okay, dual market, what's that about?
It's not just a side thing. It's fundamental to how they operate and succeed. It's how they serve two very different types of customers incredibly effectively.
Right. Lots of retailers try to serve different groups, but it sounds like O'Reilly has really nailed it. What's the secret sauce here? Is there a tricky balancing act?
Well, the secret sauce is their ability to use a single integrated infrastructure, same stores, same inventory, same distribution, to serve two distinct customer segments. And they've been refining this since way back in 1978.
Okay, who are the two segments?
On one hand, you've got the do-it-yourself customer, the DIYer. These are retail consumers, maybe like you or me sometimes, buying parts and supplies to fix or maintain their own cars.
Right, changing the oil, swapping out a headlight bulb, maybe tackling brake bands if you're feeling ambitious.
Exactly. Then on the other side, you have the do-it-for-me segment, or DIFM. They also call this the professional segment.
So mechanics, garages.
Independent repair shops, professional service providers, fleet maintenance shops. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And their needs are very different, very specific. They need timely, reliable access to a deep inventory of parts.
Because time is money for them.
Absolutely. Every minute a car sits waiting for a part on their lift, they're losing money. They can't afford delays. They need the part, the right part, now.
So it's not just that O'Reilly serves both DIY and DIM, it's how they balance it. The sources mentioned that historically it was pretty balanced, right? Like maybe 58% DIY, 42% DIFM back in 2015?
Yeah, around that split. But what's really interesting is the recent shift. We looked at the Q2 2025 earnings call.
What did that show?
It specifically called out the professional, the DIFM business, as the more significant driver of sales growth. They posted over 7% comparable store sales growth in that segment. Pretty strong.
Wow. And DIY.
DIY grew too, but it was more driven by a higher average ticket size people buying more stuff or more expensive stuff each visit. There was actually some pressure on the number of DIY transactions.
So the pros are really pushing the growth right now, but DIY is still a solid, large base.
Exactly. And what's truly ingenious about this whole setup, this balanced approach, is that the sources describe it as a powerful and inherent hedge against varying economic conditions.
Well, hedge? How so?
Think about it. When the economy is strong, people might have more disposable income. Maybe they choose the convenience of cooking their car to a professional shop for repairs.
Right. Pay someone else to do it. Boost the DIM side.
Correct. But when the economy tightens up, when people are watching their wallets,
they might decide to tackle that brake job themselves to save some money.
Exactly. Which then supports the DIY segment. So they have this built-in flexibility. It's a really key differentiator compared to, say, AutoZone, which historically has been much more heavily skewed towards DIY, like 77, 78% of their sales.
It's a huge difference in mix.
It is. And this strategic paradox, where focusing intensely on the demanding needs of the professional customer, actually improves the experience for the casual DIYer.
Yeah.
It creates this almost unfair advantage that a single-focused competitor just can't easily replicate.
That makes incredible sense strategically. It's like having two engines, as you said. If one sputters a bit, the other keeps things moving.
Hmm.
But it's not just about hedging against the economy, is it? There's an operational benefit too, this virtuous cycle idea.
Oh, absolutely. It's a masterclass in operational leverage. By serving both customer types from the exact same store, using the same pool of inventory, and leveraging that integrated distribution network.
They maximize their assets?
Precisely. They get more bang for their buck from their stores and inventory. It broadens their total market without doubling up on infrastructure costs.
Okay, but what's the virtuous part?
Ah, right. That's the clever bit. The professional DIFM segment, as we said, is incredibly demanding. They need deep inventory. If O'Reilly doesn't have the part right now, that pro might call NAPA or someone else and O'Reilly loses the sale, maybe the customer relationship.
High stakes?
Very. And they need rapid, reliable delivery, multiple times a day, often. So to win that demanding DIFM business, O'Reilly is forced to invest heavily continuously in its supply chain, its distribution centers, and its in-store stock levels.
Okay, makes sense for the pros.
But here's the cycle.
Mm.
Those very investments, which are absolutely essential for the pros, also directly benefit the DIY customer walking in off the street.
I see. The DIYer finds the part they need because the whole system is geared towards having everything.
Exactly. The high standards required by the pros elevate the experience for everyone. Plus, think about how complex cars are getting.
Way more electronics, specialized systems.
Yeah. So the line between what's a simple DIY job versus needing a pro is blurring. With this dual market strategy, O'Reilly is perfectly positioned to capture that sale, no matter who actually ends up doing the work. It makes them incredibly adaptable.
That is a powerful combination. And it's all supported by this massive physical footprint, right? The numbers are pretty staggering.
They really are. As of mid-2025, they were operating 6,483 stores.
6,483. Wow.
And that was up from 6,378 just to the end of the previous fiscal year. They're not standing still. Management's guiding for another 200 to 210 net new stores for fiscal 2025.
So adding about 3-4% more stores every year, consistently.
Consistent growth. They added 105 stores in just the first half of 2025 alone. That pace is relentless.
And why is that steady store growth so important?
It provides this predictable, reliable layer of top-line revenue growth. It's somewhat insulated from the ups and downs of the broader economy compared to, say, same-store sales. It's just a foundational part of their growth algorithm. New stores equal new revenue streams.
And they're not just sticking to the U.S., are they? There's international expansion, too.
Right. They started looking beyond the U.S. border more seriously in 2019 with the acquisition of Mayasa Auto Parts down in Mexico.
How's that going?
Seems to be going well. They just celebrated opening their 100th store in Mexico in July 2025. They've also expanded into Puerto Rico, that was May 2023, and more recently, into Canada. They acquired Vast Auto up there in 2024.
So, testing the waters in neighboring markets.
Exactly. Measured steps. These international operations are still a relatively small piece of the overall pie right now, but these moves into large, often more fragmented markets. The sources see this as representing a significant, multi-decade runway for future growth.
Applying their successful U.S. playbook elsewhere.
That's the idea. Smart, strategic positioning for the very long term.
Okay. So O'Reilly's built this really robust machine, a well-oiled operation, you could say, great strategy, disciplined expansion. But what about the road itself, the overall industry? Let's zoom out. What are the big market dynamics and macro trends they're dealing with?
Well, the industry O'Reilly plays in, the global automotive aftermarket, it's just massive and incredibly resilient, as we've touched on.
How massive are we talking?
Estimates vary slightly, but we're looking at somewhere between, say, $420 billion and maybe $468 billion globally in recent years, 2023-2024.
Billion, with a B.
With a B.
Oh.
And North America is the biggest piece of that pie, accounting for over 31% of global revenue. It's definitely a mature market, especially here.
Mature meaning slow growth.
Relatively slow, yeah.
Yeah.
But stable, long-term demand. We're not seeing explosive growth like a tech startup. Think more along the lines of overall economic growth, like GDP. Projections are for a compound annual growth rate, CAGR, somewhere in the range of 3.2% to 3.8% over the next decade.
Okay, so steady, predictable growth for the whole industry.
It is. That mature GDP-like growth profile provides a very stable operating environment. But here's the key thing. That immense scale of the market allows the big, efficient players like O'Reilly to actually grow much faster than the overall market average by consolidating market share. They systematically take business away from the smaller independent players, the mom-and-pop shops, the smaller regional chains that just don't have the same scale, buying power, or logistical muscle.
Yeah.
It's a slow, steady process of the big getting bigger in a fragmented market.
Right. And one huge driver for this whole industry, something we all kind of feel but maybe don't grasp the scale of, is the aging vehicle fleet.
Oh, it's massive. A huge tailwind.
The numbers are kind of crazy. The average age of light vehicles in the U.S. hit an all-time high, 12.6 years in 2024, and it's projected to keep climbing. Passenger cars are even older, average 14 years.
14 years old on average for a car.
It's wild. What's driving that? Are cars just lasting longer, or are people just holding on to them because new ones are so expensive?
It's really a mix of durable factors. First, yes, vehicles are generally engineered better today. They're more durable. They last longer. Fewer major breakdowns at younger ages.
Okay, better quality.
Second, absolutely. New car prices have been sky high. You've got inflation, higher interest rates making loans more expensive. It makes keeping your current car running look a lot more attractive than taking on a big new payment.
Makes sense.
And third, just general economic uncertainty. When people are worried about jobs or the economy, they tend to put off big purchases like a new car. They'll invest a bit in fixing the old one instead. So it's less about declining mobility, more about pragmatism and economics.
And this aging fleet creates a sweet spot for repairs, right?
Exactly. The prime time for repairs is typically when a vehicle is between, say, 6 and 14 years old.
Why then?
Because by then, they're usually out of the manufacturer's warranty period. And they just naturally start needing more significant component replacements. Things wear out. This specific age group of vehicles, this 6 to 14-year-old cohort, is actually expected to grow as a percentage of all cars on the road until at least 2028.
So more cars entering that prime repair age range for the next few years.
Right. It creates this strong multi-year baseline for robust demand for the parts and services O'Reilly and its peers provide. It's a really significant tailwind.
Okay, so aging cars are good for business, but we can't talk about the auto industry's future without tackling the elephant in the garage. Electric vehicles.
Yeah.
EVs.
The big one.
The global EV market is expanding incredibly fast, like 40% plus annual growth. And the sources call this the most significant long-term structural challenge. Why such strong wording?
Because it's a fundamental shift in vehicle technology. Battery electric vehicles, BEVs, are just built differently than traditional cars with internal combustion engines, ICE vehicles. They have far fewer moving parts. Significantly fewer. This design difference means they completely eliminate the need for over 150 different component types that are standard on ICE vehicles.
150 fewer types of parts? Like what?
Think about everything related to the engine itself.
Yeah.
The fuel system, fuel pumps, injectors, filters, the entire exhaust system,
yeah.
Mufflers, catalytic converters,
yeah.
All gone in a pure BEV. That's a huge chunk of the traditional aftermarket parts catalog.
Okay, that definitely sounds like a major challenge long term. A threat, really.
It is a very real long-term threat to a large part of the current business.
But is it all negative? Are there any new opportunities EVs create? Any silver lining?
There are. It's not entirely negative, and crucially, the impact is deferred, which is really important timing-wise.
Okay, deferred how?
Well, while maybe 150 part types go away, EVs actually create demand for over 40 new component categories, things specific to electric drivetrains.
Like what?
Electric motors themselves, the high-voltage battery packs, complex power control units, specialized thermal management systems to keep the batteries cool or warm. These are all new parts categories.
Interesting. Anything else?
Yeah, a couple of other things. Because EVs are typically heavier and have that instant torque from the electric motor, they tend to wear out tires about 20% faster than similar IC cars.
Ah, so more tire sales potentially.
Potentially. They also require specialized brake systems, often regenerative braking, combined with traditional friction brakes and unique cooling components. These all create new revenue streams. So it's not a total wipeout of parts demand. It's a significant shift in which parts are needed. It requires adaptation.
And you mentioned the timing is crucial. The impact is deferred. Why?
Because the average age of EVs on the road today is still very young. Only about 3.5 years old on average.
Meaning most are still under warranty.
Exactly. The vast majority are still covered by the manufacturer's warranty. They haven't really entered that prime 6 to 14-year-old repair window yet where they typically need aftermarket parts.
Right. People aren't paying out of pocket for many EV repairs yet.
Correct. And some research even suggests that the overall cost of routine maintenance and parts repair for an EV could be as much as 60% lower than for a comparable ICE vehicle over its lifetime.
60% lower, wow.
Yeah. So while EVs represent a formidable long-term headwind, the immediate growth O'Reilly is getting from that aging ICE fleet far outweighs any current negative impact from the still very young EV repair market.
So if you connect the dots, this actually creates a sort of golden era for the traditional aftermarket business right now, doesn't it? A window of opportunity before the EV transition really hits full force.
That's exactly how some analysts are framing it. The data suggests this golden era is likely to last until the early 2030s.
Why then?
Well, that prime repair cohort of ICE vehicles, the 6 to 14-year-olds, is expected to peak around 2028. But those cars will still be on the road needing repairs for many years after that. Meanwhile, it's probably going to take until around 2030 for a really significant number of EVs to reach that 8 to 10 year age range.
Which is when they might start needing major out-of-warranty repairs.
Right. Things like maybe a battery pack replacement, which can be a very expensive repair and a big opportunity for the aftermarket if they're ready for it.
So this gives companies like O'Reilly a strategic window, maybe 5 to 7 years?
Exactly. A window where their traditional business should continue generating really strong cash flow. The companies that will win in the next era are the ones that use this time, use this cash flow wisely.
How? What do they need to do?
They need to reinvest that cash into building the capabilities for the electric future. Developing expertise in battery logistics, handling, storing, shipping those big, heavy batteries, maybe getting into battery remanufacturing, acquiring specialized tools and diagnostic equipment for EVs, and crucially, investing heavily in technician training, both for their own staff and potentially for their professional customers.
So it's a critical period of investment and adaptation, not just riding out the ICE wave.
Absolutely. Adapt or risk getting left behind when the tide fully turns.
Okay, so EVs are the big long-term disruptor. What about the other major trend? E-commerce and digitalization. How's that shaking up the auto parts world?
E-commerce has definitely added another layer of competition and forced transformation. Online sales of auto parts and accessories in the U.S. are big business, projected around $44 billion in 2024.
$44 billion online? That's huge.
It is. And it's not just the direct sales. Online research now influences an estimated $168 billion in total retail parts sales. Think about that.
So even if you buy in-store, you probably checked prices or availability online first.
Very likely. A huge number, something like 73% of consumers, use retailer websites as part of their buying process. So having a strong digital presence for information, for price comparison, is absolutely essential now.
That's a massive online influence. But still, like, if my battery dies suddenly, I need one now. I can't wait 2 days for shipping. I feel like I'd still go to a physical store. Is that just me?
No, not at all. You're hitting on a really key point, a structural advantage for the brick and mortar guys. Despite all the growth in online sales, the data shows the majority of consumers still prefer to buy auto parts in a physical store.
And the main reason is?
Convenience. Just like your battery example, many, many auto repairs are urgent, unplanned. Your car won't start, your wiper fails in a storm, your brakes start grinding. You need that part immediately to get back on the road.
Right. Amazon Prime can't deliver a starter motor in 30 minutes.
Not yet, anyway. Pure play e-commerce platforms just can't compete on that immediate availability dimension for urgent needs.
So the winning strategy isn't pure online, it's what? Omnichannel?
Exactly. Omnichannel is the name of the game. It's about seamlessly blending a robust online presence for the research, the price checks, maybe ordering non-urgent items with that dense physical store network for the immediate pickup, the expert advice in person, handling returns easily.
Got it. So the website and the store have to work together perfectly.
Perfectly. That integration is the critical battleground now. Companies that can't effectively blend the digital and physical experiences will likely struggle to capture the whole customer journey and will probably lose share.
It really sounds like there are significant barriers to entry in this business, especially at scale, these competitive moats that protect players like O'Reilly.
Absolutely. The barriers are formidable for anyone trying to start from scratch or challenge the incumbents head on at a national level.
What are the biggest moats?
Well, first, just sheer scale and purchasing power. O'Reilly buys enormous volumes from suppliers, giving them significant leverage to negotiate favorable pricing and terms that smaller players just can't get.
Okay, buying power. What else?
Second, that dense nationwide store network. Building thousands of stores in the right locations takes massive capital investment and, frankly, decades of execution, finding sites, building or leasing, staffing. It's a huge physical barrier. And that network is critical for the convenience and immediate availability customers demand.
Right. You can't replicate 6,000 plus stores overnight.
Not even close. But perhaps the most critical moat, the one that's hardest for anyone else to replicate and would truly cripple O'Reilly if they lost it, is their sophisticated, multi-tiered supply chain and distribution network.
Okay, why is that the absolute core advantage?
Because managing hundreds of thousands, literally hundreds of thousands of unique part numbers or SKUs for all the different cars and trucks out there,
yeah,
and ensuring those parts are available in the right store at the right time, it's incredibly complex.
Mind-boggling complexity.
It is. It requires huge investments in distribution centers, inventory management systems, logistics, trucking fleets. O'Reilly has built this incredibly efficient system over decades to achieve high in-stock levels, often with multiple deliveries to stores per day. Replicating that logistical capability, extremely difficult, time-consuming, and expensive for anyone else. It's the engine behind their convenience and reliability promise.
So buying power, store network, and that killer supply chain.
Those moats together create this really durable competitive advantage. It lets O'Reilly defend its position and continue that slow, steady consolidation of the fragmented industry.
Okay, so O'Reilly clearly benefits from these industry dynamics, has strong moats protecting it, but how does it actually stack up against its direct rivals, the other big names people know? Let's shift focus now to the competitive landscape. Who's really in the driver's seat here?
Right. The U.S. aftermarket, while fragmented overall, is definitely concentrated at the top among the big retailers. You've got O'Reilly, ORY, AutoZone, AZO, and Advance Auto Parts, AEP, as the main publicly traded players.
And NAPA.
And Genuine Parts Company, or GPC, which operates the NAPA Auto Parts stores. NAPA's a huge player, especially on the professional, the DIFM side we talked about.
Okay, so those are the big four, basically. How do they compare? Market cap seems like a good place to start how much investors think they're worth.
Yeah, and looking at mid-2025 data, O'Reilly actually leads the pack here by a significant margin. Their market cap was around $87.5
billion. $87.5 billion. Okay, how about the others?
AutoZone was second, pretty large too, at $69.7 billion. But then a big drop off to Genuine Parts Company at $19.4 billion and Advance Auto Parts way down at $3.6 billion.
Wow, that's a massive gap between O'Reilly, AutoZone, and the others. That $87 billion for O'Reilly really suggests investors see something special there.
It certainly points to high expectations and a recognition of their consistent performance. Now, foot traffic data tells a slightly different story or adds nuance.
Well, so?
Well, in Q1 2024, based on visit data, AutoZone actually had the largest share of visits, around 40%. O'Reilly was second at about 32%.
So more people walking into AutoZone.
In that period, yes. But here's the interesting part, the momentum. Looking at year-over-year growth in Q2 2024, O'Reilly's store visits grew faster, up 6.7%. AutoZone grew too, but slower, at 4.4%.
Ah, so O'Reilly seems to be gaining ground, attracting customers at a faster rate.
That's what the data suggests, yeah, gaining share, and maybe even more telling is customer loyalty.
How do they measure that?
Looking at repeat visits, in April 2024, a remarkable 52% of visits to O'Reilly stores were from repeat customers.
Over half were returning customers.
Exactly. That was the highest percentage among the major competitors. It points to a really strong, sticky customer relationship. People aren't just trying once, they're coming back. That's a powerful asset.
Okay, let's dive into some financial and operational comparisons from, say, fiscal year 2023. How do they stack up on revenue?
In FY23, AutoZone actually had the highest total revenue, with O'Reilly coming in second. So AutoZone was slightly bigger on the top line that year.
But what about profitability, margins?
That's where O'Reilly and AutoZone really shine together. Their gross margins were very similar and very strong. O'Reilly was at 51.3%, AutoZone at 52.0%.
And the others?
Advance Auto Parts was significantly lower, around 40.1%. So O'Reilly and AutoZone are clearly converting more of each sales dollar into gross profit.
And does that carry through to operating margin after expenses?
It does. O'Reilly's operating margin was 20.2%, AutoZone right there at 19.9%. Both are absolute leaders in the industry on operating efficiency.
And Advance.
Way, way lower. Just 1.0% operating margin in FY23. A huge gap, highlighting significant operational challenges there compared to the top two.
Okay, what about store count? Who has the most locations?
Interestingly, Genuine Parts Company, through NAPA, actually has the largest store network, partly due to their franchise model. AutoZone has the second most, and then O'Reilly is third among that group in terms of total store numbers.
But O'Reilly's distinctiveness comes back to that DIY DIFM mix, right?
Absolutely. That's where O'Reilly really stands out. Their balance is unique, estimated around 42% DIY, 58% DIFM in recent periods.
Compared to
AutoZone, which is heavily skewed towards DIY, maybe 75% DIY, 25% DIFM. And NAPA is the opposite, heavily skewed towards the professional DIF side, maybe 20% DIY, 80% DIFM.
So O'Reilly's right in the middle, playing both sides effectively.
Playing both sides very effectively. That balance is a core part of their identity and strategy.
And you mentioned earlier this translates into their valuation.
It seems to. That balance, combined with their track record of strong, consistent execution, likely contributes to why O'Reilly consistently commands that premium valuation, the highest market cap, the highest price-to-earnings ratio among its peers. The market seems to value that unique model and reliable performance.
What about return on invested capital, ROIC? How good are they at making money from their investments?
They are exceptionally good. O'Reilly's ROIC is really top-tier elite level. Now, you might see different numbers depending on the source.
Yeah, you mentioned Morningstar might say 40%, but O'Reilly's own calculations might be over 70%. Why the difference?
It usually comes down to slight differences in how invested capital is defined and calculated. What counts as capital? How do you adjust for leases, etc.? But the key takeaway isn't the exact number. It's that both figures, whether it's 40% or 70% plus Edeldo, are incredibly high. World-class returns.
Indicating extreme efficiency.
Extreme capital efficiency. They're fantastic at deploying capital and generating substantial profits from it. AutoZone also shows very strong ROIC, by the way. But Advance Auto Parts, in contrast, had a negative ROIC in that period, highlighting significant issues with generating returns on their investments.
A really stark difference between the leaders and laggards there. So O'Reilly's performing at an elite level financially and operationally. It really begs the question, how do they do it? What are the core advantages, the differentiating factors that keep them ahead?
Okay, let's break down those advantages. At the absolute core, maybe the biggest single factor is their superior supply chain and distribution network.
We talked about that as a moat. How does it function as an advantage day to day?
It's not just big. It's incredibly sophisticated. It's multi-tiered, designed specifically to maximize the availability of parts at the store level, where the customer interaction happens. And they keep investing heavily here.
Like the new distribution centers.
Exactly. They've got two massive new distribution centers, or DCs, under construction right now. One in Texas, one in Virginia. Each one is designed to service up to 350 stores.
350 stores from one DC. Wow.
It's huge scale. This does two things. It relieves capacity constraints in their existing network, allowing them to handle more volume efficiently. And it enables further expansion, particularly into markets where they're currently underpenetrated, like the Mid-Atlantic region.
And this logistical muscle translates directly to
superior in-stock positions, having the part the customer needs when they need it, and faster, more reliable delivery times, especially crucial for those professional DIFM customers whose businesses depend on speed.
Okay, supply chain is number one. What else?
Number two is their effective dual market execution. Mastering that strategy, serving both DIY and DIFM efficiently from the same assets, it creates significant operational leverage. It makes their stores more productive. And it provides that natural economic hedge we discussed that contributes directly to their consistent financial results.
Makes sense. What's next?
It's not just systems and strategy, it's people. Their strong customer loyalty and service culture is a real differentiator.
That 52% repeat customer rate you mentioned.
Exactly. That doesn't happen by accident. The sources point to a deeply ingrained culture focused on excellent customer service, delivered by knowledgeable professional parts people. They invest in training their team. This focus on helpful expert service builds those sticky relationships and keeps customers coming back.
So good parts availability plus good service.
It's a powerful combination. And finally, you just can't ignore their track record of consistent operational excellence.
The 32-year streak.
That remarkable, frankly rare, 32 consecutive years of positive comparable store sales growth and record earnings through fiscal 2024. That kind of consistency, navigating recessions, booms, competitive threats, it's almost unheard of in retail.
And that earns them credibility.
Immense credibility with investors. It signals a management team that knows how to execute year after year in different environments. And that consistency is a major reason the market awards it that premium valuation.
Sure.
It reduces perceived risk.
Okay, this consistent operational excellence, these advantages, they clearly show up in the financial results. Let's pivot now to the financial dashboard. Dig into the performance, the growth drivers, and how they use their capital. What's the financial story boil down to?
The financial story is one of long, consistent, profitable growth. It's a narrative of compounding value creation over decades. They've proven they can navigate all sorts of economic weather, competitive shifts, operational hurdles.
And the numbers back that up. Looking at, say, 2019 to 2024, that covers pre-pandemic, the pandemic itself, and the inflationary period after.
Absolutely. Across that entire period, you see this picture of steady top-line growth, really robust profitability, and just exceptional returns on the capital they invest.
Let's put some numbers on that. Revenue growth.
Total revenue grew from about $10.15 billion in 2019 to roughly $16.71 billion in 2024.
Whoa. That's like a 65% increase in 5 years on an already huge base.
Significant growth, yeah. And crucially, they did it profitably. Gross margins stayed consistently above 51% the whole time, landing around 51.2% in 2024. That shows real pricing power and purchasing strength.
And operating margin, overall efficiency.
Also very consistent. Stayed in that strong 19-21% range, ending 2024 at 19.5%. And the bottom line for shareholders, diluted earnings per share, EPS.
The profit per share.
Right. That grew from $17.88 in 2019 to an impressive $40.66 in 2024, more than doubled in 5 years. These aren't just abstract numbers. They represent real, tangible value being created and compounded for shareholders.
That is a powerful growth story.
Yep.
What's actually driving that revenue expansion? Where does the growth come from?
It's really that dual-engine approach, again, similar to their customer strategy. First, you have comparable store sales growth, often called comps or same-store sales.
Which measures growth in stores open at least a year, right? Shows underlying health.
Exactly. And O'Reilly's track record here is just exceptional. As we keep mentioning, 32 consecutive years of positive comps. That's the bedrock. It shows they're consistently taking market share, managing pricing effectively, and keeping existing stores productive.
Even during and after the pandemic surge.
Yeah, even after those huge growth years like 10.9% comps in 2020, 13.3% in 2021, fueled by stimulus and shifts in spending, they kept growing. They put up 7.9% in 2023 and 2.9% in 2024.
Huh.
Growing consistently on top of that much larger base is impressive.
Okay, so strong organic growth from existing stores. What's the second engine?
The second engine is new store openings. They supplement that organic growth by consistently, methodically, disciplinedly expanding their physical footprint.
The 180-200 net new stores per year figure.
Right. This provides a predictable, reliable layer of top-line growth that's a bit less sensitive to macro fluctuations than same-store sales. It just keeps adding new revenue streams year after year. It's their growth algorithm.
Mm.
Strong comps plus steady new unit growth.
Makes sense. And on the profitability side, those margins really are impressive, especially gross margin being better than many competitors. How do they maintain that?
That consistent gross margin above 51%, it really speaks to several core strengths working together. Their huge purchasing scale gives them leverage with suppliers. They have an effective pricing strategy. They're competitive, but they clearly maintain discipline to protect profitability.
Private label brands probably help too.
Absolutely. A favorable sales mix, including their own higher margin private label brands, definitely contributes. And finally, just disciplined inventory management, minimizing obsolescence and shrinkage. All those factors help protect that gross margin, even when costs are rising.
And the stable operating margin in the 19-21% range.
That's the direct result of those strong gross margins combined with good control over their operating expenses,
Yeah. The
selling, general, and administrative costs, or SG&A. They manage their store labor, distribution costs, and corporate overhead effectively.
Okay, strong growth, strong margins. But what really seems to set them apart in the financials is the return on capital and the cash generation. You called them elite.
They really are. O'Reilly's business model is just exceptionally efficient at generating high returns on the capital it actually uses. That return on invested capital, ROIC, we talked about,
Yeah. Whether
you calculate it as 40% or over 70%, the sheer magnitude is what matters.
What does that magnitude tell you?
It tells you this is a business with a powerful competitive moat that requires surprisingly little incremental capital to generate substantial profits. They are just excellent at taking a dollar of capital and turning it into significantly more than a dollar of value year after year.
And that efficiency leads to strong cash flow.
Directly. High capital efficiency translates into robust and predictable free cash flow, FCF generation. Remember, FCF is the cash left over after running the business and maintaining assets. For fiscal 2025, they guided for $1.6 billion to $1.9 billion in free cash flow.
Almost $2 billion in cash generated in a year.
Yeah. And that powerful cash flow is the engine that fuels everything else. It allows them to fund their organic growth, the new stores, the new DCs, and execute that very aggressive capital return program for shareholders.
Right. Let's talk about that capital allocation. How do they decide where the cash goes? It's a very specific approach, isn't it? And notably, no dividend.
It's very clear and consistently applied. Priority number one is always reinvesting in the business, specifically in high return organic growth initiatives. That means funding the annual new store program, investing in expanding and modernizing the distribution network, upgrading technology, things like that.
Growth first.
High return organic growth first. After that, they'll look at strategic acquisitions, like the ones in Mexico or Canada, if the opportunity makes sense and meets their return criteria.
And only after funding growth.
Only after fully funding those internal and external growth opportunities do they return essentially all the remaining free cash flow to shareholders.
And the main way they do that is through share repurchases or buybacks, which have been enormous.
Absolutely massive. O'Reilly doesn't currently pay a dividend, which is pretty common among their growth-focused peers in the industry. They prefer to return capital via buybacks. And their buyback program is one of the largest and most consistent you'll find anywhere in retail.
How much have they bought back?
Since the program started back in January 2011 through mid-2025, the company had repurchased a staggering $26.59 billion worth of its own stock.
$26.5 billion.
It's huge. Just in the first half of 2025, they spent another $1.18 billion buying back 13.3 million shares. This sustained reduction in the number of shares outstanding is a really powerful driver of earnings per share growth over the long term. It makes each remaining share inherently more valuable.
And they actually use debt to help fund these buybacks, right? Which leads to that shareholders deficit thing on the balance sheet. That sounds bad, but you said it's not.
Right. It's an important accounting nuance to understand. O'Reilly does use debt, prudently, to help finance the share repurchase program. Their strong, stable cash flows support this leverage. Now, because they've returned so much capital to shareholders via these buybacks over many years, often more capital than their cumulative reported net income, it creates a negative book value, or shareholders' deficit, on the balance sheet.
Which means assets minus liabilities is negative.
Technically, yes, the book value of equity is negative. But for a company like O'Reilly, this is not a sign of financial distress. It's actually a direct and intentional consequence of their capital allocation strategy. It signals a highly efficient capital structure from the perspective of equity holders.
How is negative equity efficient?
Think of it this way. They're not letting excess capital sit idly on the balance sheet earning low returns. They're actively returning it to shareholders, primarily through buybacks, which, if done well, increases the value of the remaining shares. They've essentially given back more than their accounting book value, but the underlying business remains a powerful cash-generating machine. It's a sign they're sweating their assets hard and maximizing returns for the owners.
Okay, that makes more sense. It's counterintuitive, but it's about efficiency, not distress. Still, while the financial picture is clearly strong, growth isn't guaranteed, right? And even O'Reilly faces challenges. Let's look ahead now. What are the strategies for future growth, and what potential bumps in the road are they navigating?
Management has a pretty clear, multi-pronged strategy for growth. The primary engine, the most predictable driver, remains that new store expansion, targeting 190 to 10 net new stores a year. It's methodical, supported by that distribution network build-out, and allows them to keep capturing share in this fragmented market.
Okay, steady domestic store growth. What else?
International growth is the second key pillar, focused on the long term. Their approach is measured, strategic, focusing on adjacent markets, Mexico, Canada, Puerto Rico, so far, where they can replicate their successful U.S. operating model.
Mexico hitting 100 stores, getting a new DC, looks like they're committed there.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And Canada and Puerto Rico, being more recent entries, offer really long runways for growth if they can execute effectively.
Sure.
It's about exporting that winning formula.
And what about the digital side, e-commerce? Are they trying to become the Amazon of auto parts?
Not really. Their digital transformation and e-commerce strategy isn't about beating the pure play online guys at their own game. It's about creating that seamless omnichannel experience we talked about, leveraging their biggest strength, the physical stores.
So using digital to enhance the store experience.
Exactly. They know many purchase journeys start online research, checking inventory. So they have a robust platform, O'ReillyAuto.com, around since 1999. It's tightly integrated with the stores for things like buy online, pick up in store, BOPIS, checking local availability, even same day delivery in many areas for urgent needs.
And the mobile app helps too.
Yeah. The mobile app with features like the VIN scanner is key. Scan your car's vehicle identification number, and it helps ensure you get the right part. That reduces a major customer pain point ordering the wrong thing. It's all about making it easy to get the right part right now, however the customer wants to shop.
So store growth, international, omnichannel. And all this feeds into the ultimate goal of gaining market share.
Precisely. At the end of the day, O'Reilly's organic growth comes from market share gains. The aftermarket is still full of smaller, independent operators who just can't compete on scale, inventory, or technology. O'Reilly aims to systematically win business from them, especially on the DIM side, where their speed and reliability are huge advantages. Management talks about growing from their current 10% market share to a much larger number over time.
Okay, that's the growth plan. But no company cruises forever without hitting some bumps. What have been the main challenges or headwinds O'Reilly's faced recently, say, in the last couple of years?
Yeah, they've definitely navigated some headwinds. First, inflationary pressures. That's been a double-edged sword.
How?
On one side, rising costs for everything, the parts themselves, freight to ship them, labor to sell them. They've generally been able to pass those costs on, but it requires constant vigilance to protect margins. On the other side, inflation squeezes consumer budgets, especially for the lower-income DIY customer. That led to some softness in more discretionary categories, things like tools, accessories, performance parts. People prioritized essential repairs. Management has sounded cautious about how much more price increase consumers can absorb.
Okay, inflation pressure. What else?
Second, SG&A expense growth. Their operating expenses have actually been growing faster than their sales in some recent quarters.
Like Q1 2025, you mentioned 8% SG&A growth versus 4% sales growth. Why?
Several reasons. Wage inflation is a big one they need to pay competitively to attract and retain those knowledgeable professional parts people who are key to their service model. They're also making strategic investments in their team and technology. And sometimes there are just atypical costs. Like in Q4 2024, they took a $35 million charge related to self-insurance liabilities for auto claims that hit earnings directly.
Ouch. Okay, cost pressures. Any others?
Third, ongoing supply chain and tariff uncertainty. While the crazy disruptions of the pandemic have eased, the global supply chain is still complex and somewhat uncertain. Management specifically flags the changing tariff landscape as a risk that's hard to predict and can impact costs and sourcing decisions. They're actively working on diversifying where they get their products from to mitigate this.
Makes sense. Labor issues.
Fourth, labor market challenges are persistent. It's still a tight market for skilled workers. Attracting, training, and retaining their large workforce requires competitive wages and benefits, putting continuous pressure on costs, as seen in that SG&A growth.
And finally, just the difficulty of continuing high growth.
Fifth, exactly. They're lapping tough comparisons. It's the law of large numbers. After those years of exceptionally strong growth driven by stimulus, pandemic shifts, even favorable weather sometimes, posting high single-digit or double-digit comps gets harder and harder. Management acknowledges these tough comparisons, and sometimes unpredictable factors like weather can make quarter-to-quarter results look volatile.
Okay, so navigating those challenges really underscores the importance of strong leadership. Let's talk about the people behind the wheel. Management quality, corporate governance at O'Reilly. What's the verdict there?
What's really fascinating, and I think a key strength, is the sheer depth of experience on their leadership team. We're talking decades, often within O'Reilly itself, or at least within the auto aftermarket industry.
They have a promote from within culture, right?
Very strong promote from within culture. This ensures leadership continuity, a deep understanding of the company's operational playbook, and preservation of their cultural values. People grow up in the business.
Any examples?
Sure. Brad Beckham, the CEO since February 2024, was co-president before that clear internal succession. Greg Hensley, the executive chairman, has over 40 years with the company, was CEO from 2005 to 2018. David O'Reilly, executive vice chairman from the founding family, has over 50 years there, led the IPO back in 93. Even the previous CEO, Gregory Johnson, spent his entire 40-plus year career there, started in a DC.
Wow, that's incredible tenure in internal development.
It really is. That deep operational knowledge and long tenure at the top are huge assets for consistent execution.
And what about the board? And how is executive pay structured to align with shareholders?
The board seems well structured. A good mix of affiliated directors who know the company inside out and independent directors bringing external expertise in areas like retail, finance, supply chain. Crucially, the key committee's audit, human capital and compensation, governance are composed of independent directors providing proper oversight.
And compensation, does it incentivize the right things?
It appears well aligned. Executive compensation is heavily performance-based. The annual cash bonus, for example, is tied to specific metrics like comparable store sales growth, operating income growth, ROIC targets, and free cash flow generation.
So tied directly to business performance.
Right. And the majority of their long-term compensation is in stock options, which directly links their payout to long-term stock price appreciation, aligning them with shareholder interests. Plus, they have significant stock ownership guidelines, requiring executives and directors to hold a substantial amount of O'Reilly stock personally. Skin in the game.
So strong management, good governance structure, but even the best-run ships face potential storms. What are the main risk factors, the road hazards O'Reilly needs to watch out for?
You're right. No business is without risk. We can group them. First, strategic and competitive risks.
Like the economy.
Yeah. Despite their resilience, a really severe economic downturn could still hurt them if it significantly reduces miles driven or forces deep cuts in consumer spending. And intense competition is always there from AutoZone, NAPA, Advance, but also mass merchandisers like Walmart, car dealerships, parts departments, and increasingly online retailers. That competition always creates potential pricing pressure.
And the big one, EVs.
Absolutely. The most significant long-term strategic risk remains that long-term EV transition. If O'Reilly fails to adapt its parts mix, its supply chain, its service offerings effectively over the coming decade as the vehicle fleet electrifies, it could genuinely threaten their future growth and profitability. That's the existential one, long-term.
Any other strategic risks?
Just the ongoing challenge of future growth execution. Finding good new store locations gets harder over time. Integrating future acquisitions smoothly always carries risk.
Okay, those are strategic. What about operational or financial risks?
On the operational and financial side, supply chain disruptions are always a risk. Geopolitical events, tariffs, shipping problems, key supplier issues, anything that impacts parts availability or cost. Their heavy reliance on IT systems makes them vulnerable to failures or cybersecurity attacks, which could be massively disruptive.
Labor again.
Labor market challenges, attracting, training, retaining that large skilled workforce, remains a constant operational hurdle and cost pressure point. On the balance sheet, their use of debt to fund buybacks, while managed prudently now, does expose them to risks from rising interest rates or a potential credit rating downgrade if performance faltered. And finally, regulatory and legal risks, changes in environmental laws, employment regulations, tax laws, all can impact their operations and costs. These are all things management has to actively monitor and mitigate.
Definitely a lot to keep an eye on. These risks are real, highlighting that even leaders operate in a dynamic world. So how does the market weigh all these strengths, the moats, the execution, the financials against these risks? Let's talk about the price tag now, valuation. What does it mean for you, the listener?
Right. If we connect everything back to the stock price, the big picture is that O'Reilly consistently trades at a significant premium compared to its direct peers on almost every standard valuation metric you look at.
A premium price. Can you give us some numbers to illustrate that, like price to earnings?
Sure. Using trailing 12-month TTM data from around mid-2025, O'Reilly's PE ratio was about 36.6x.
Okay, 36.6. How does that compare?
AutoZone was lower, around 27.8x. Genuine Parts Company, NAPA's parent, was about 24.0x. And Advance Auto Parts had negative earnings, so its PE wasn't meaningful, but clearly much lower implied valuation based on other metrics. So yeah, O'Reilly's PE is substantially higher. Investors are paying more for each dollar of its earnings.
Does that premium hold on other metrics too, like EBITDA or price sales?
It does. On an enterprise value to EBITDA basis, TTM, O'Reilly was around 25.1x. AutoZone was about 18.9x. GPC much lower at 13.4x. Even Advance, despite struggles, had a high EBITDAX, but likely due to depressed EBITDA. On price sales TTM, O'Reilly was at 5.2x, while AutoZone was 3.8x, and Advance and GPC were both below 1x. So yes, across the board earnings, EBITDA sales O'Reilly commands a premium multiple.
And it's not just a premium to peers, but also to its own history, right?
That's a really important point. O'Reilly's current PE of around 36x is more than 40% higher than its own five-year average PE, which was closer to 25x.
So the market's expectations for O'Reilly have clearly increased significantly in recent years. It's being valued more richly even compared to its own past performance.
Exactly. It suggests investors are pricing in a lot of future success, anticipating continued strong growth and execution. The stock has been re-rated upwards.
So this raises the crucial question for anyone looking at this. Why does the market consistently award O'Reilly this premium valuation? What justifies paying more?
It's not based on nothing. The market's willingness to pay up is rooted in those fundamental strengths we've discussed. One, superior profitability, consistently delivering those top-tier growth and operating margins. Two, exceptional returns on capital. That industry-leading ROIC shows they're incredibly efficient at generating profits from their investments. Three, consistency and predictability. That 32-year track record of uninterrupted comp sales growth and record earnings. In an uncertain world, investors pay a premium for that kind of reliability. And four, effective capital allocation. Their disciplined reinvestment strategy combined with that aggressive value-enhancing share buyback program is seen as a major positive for long-term shareholder value.
Okay, so the premium is based on tangible performance and strategy. But the big question for you, our listener, comes down to this, right? Does O'Reilly's proven excellence and clear growth path justify paying such a significant premium both to peers and to its own historical levels?
That's the crux of it. The current valuation appears to fully price in, as they say, a continuation of this outstanding performance. Mm-hmm. It implies less room for error, less margin of safety if they hit unexpected bumps, compared to competitors trading at lower multiples.
It's a high bar the market has set. They expect continued perfection to maintain this valuation.
It's the critical judgment call any potential investor or observer needs to make. Does the quality justify the price?
Indeed. Okay, so for anyone watching O'Reilly closely or just trying to understand this industry better, what specific signs or metrics should you monitor to keep a pulse on the business? Let's wrap up with a kind of pre-trip checklist, the key things to watch.
Right. If you want to track their progress, focus on these key performance indicators or KPIs. First, top line momentum and health. The absolute most critical metric is same-store sales growth. Watch that quarterly number closely.
And within same-store sales,
break it down into its components. Ticket count or transaction count, which tells you about customer traffic volume is going up or down. And average ticket size, which reflects how much people are spending per visit, driven by items per basket, product mix shifts, and price inflation. Also, definitely watch the DIY versus DIFM breakdown within those comps. That tells you how each side of their dual market strategy is performing and spots shifts in consumer behavior.
Okay, top line health. What about profitability?
For profitability and operational efficiency, keep an eye on gross margin. Is it holding steady, expanding, or compressing? Sustained compression would be a red flag, possibly signaling competitive pressure or cost issues. Then, operating margin, which shows overall profitability after all operating expenses. You want to see that remain stable or improve, indicating cost control and scale benefits. And related to that, track SG&A as a percentage of sales. If that ratio is consistently climbing, it means expenses are growing faster than sales, which will eventually squeeze profits.
Got it. Margins and expense control. Finally, what about capital efficiency and shareholder returns, which are so core to their story?
Definitely track inventory per store or overall inventory turns. Inventory is their biggest investment and key to parts availability. You want to see efficient management here, enough inventory to serve customers well, but not so much that it ties up excess capital or risks obsolescence. Return on invested capital, ROIC, is crucial. Given its role in justifying the premium valuation, any significant decline here would be a major warning sign about their capital efficiency. Monitor free cash flow, FCF generation. Is it strong and growing? That's the fuel for growth and buybacks. And lastly, given its importance, track their share repurchase activity each quarter. How much are they buying back, at what pace, and at what average price?
Excellent checklist. Okay, let's try to tie a bow on this deep dive. We've really covered a lot of ground on O'Reilly Automotive, from its unique dual market strategy and that incredibly robust supply chain,
to its really impressive financial track record, decade after decade.
And how it's strategically navigating these big industry shifts like EVs and e-commerce. It's clear O'Reilly is a market leader, operates with a strong competitive moat.
But it also faces real headwinds like inflation, cost pressures, and that long-term EV transition risk. And it carries a demanding market valuation.
Right. So here's the final provocative thought for you, our listener, to chew on. Thinking about O'Reilly's future and the whole industry, how do you think this evolving landscape of vehicle ownership, especially this accelerating shift towards electric vehicles, and maybe those blurring lines between DIY and professional repairs, how will that ultimately reshape the entire automotive aftermarket over the next decade?
Yeah, where does that leave a traditional parts retailer like O'Reilly 10 years from now?
Will O'Reilly's investments during this golden era, the new DCs, the tech upgrades, maybe EV capabilities, will those pay off and allow them to dominate the future? Or could we see new kinds of players emerge, maybe from unexpected places like tech companies focusing on diagnostics or software, potentially disrupting the whole concept of vehicle maintenance and making physical parts, well, less central?
It's a fascinating question. Hmm? Will the incumbents adapt successfully, or will disruption come from outside?
Something to think about, not just for O'Reilly, but maybe for your own next vehicle choice and how you'll maintain it and what it means for the broader economy.